A weekend story in the New York Times profiled a white nationalist and Nazi sympathizer. The story generated such backlash that the paper released an editor's note, and the reporter himself wrote about his thoughts and experiences in reporting on that story. We're examining the role of media outlets and their ethical obligations during this hour. Earlier this week, Wisconsin Public Radio aired an extended feature story on a group called the Proud Boys. They call themselves a fraternal organization for libertarians. We'll have an opportunity to listen to the piece later in the hour. Since it first aired, we've heard from you, and we want to take this opportunity to bring you into the editorial thought process on this. We're shedding light on the decision-making that led to a story which prompts people from all political perspectives to speak up. Alexandra Hall spent months reporting on Proud Boys. She is WPR's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her piece is titled Controversial Proud Boys Embrace Western Values, Reject Feminism and Political Correctness. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Your story, it was released earlier this week. On our Facebook post about it, James writes, "Why should we be giving these things any media exposure?" And he's not alone. Why did you decide the story of the Proud Boys is worth telling and is worth hearing or reading?
Well, we definitely had that conversation. I've asked myself that same question more than once. And the answer to that question came through doing the reporting. We first found out about the Proud Boys through an incident that occurred in Madison in May, in which a member of their group, they had had a meetup, the first official meetup of the group. All the members were meeting each other for the first time in person. One of the members was separated from the group and was ambushed and beaten severely by a group of men who the victim later stated he believed were members of Antifa, anti-fascist activists. And so we started looking into the group. This project, or the story, was a part of a collaboration with ProPublica. They're doing a documenting hate project that looks into tips about incidents of hate and bias in different areas of the country. So we wanted to find if there were any hate groups or hate group activity in Wisconsin. We heard about this. I started looking deeper into their ideas about venerating entrepreneurs, Western values, a rejection of political correctness, which is why a lot of them feel very supportive of President Trump and his leadership style. And I started corresponding with a few of their members. Many of them didn't want to talk to me, but their president reached out to me, and we had an exchange that was pretty inappropriate and, to me, spoke very loudly, more than anything that they could say about their own beliefs. It spoke very loudly about how they correspond with women and with journalists. And in working with this documenting hate project, it kind of surprised me that 95% and up of the reporting that's going on in the country as a part of this collaboration is solely about race. No one's really talking about the misogyny and sexism that these groups espouse. And so I felt that that was worth looking further into. And to speak to that question about whether or not it's worth to tell these stories, really it came down to my own curiosity and my editor's curiosity about this gray area, that it's not just, are you a Nazi or are you not a Nazi? The spectrum of alt-right white nationalists is wide and multi-layered and confusing, and we decided that it is worth it to talk about the gray areas.
So you spent months doing interviews and talking with people, months of work, so much research, so much content, so much gray area, as you say. How did you decide what quotes to use?
That's a good question. The Proud Boys' ideas are very diverse. They're kind of all over the place, as we mentioned in the story. They vary from shutting down the government to quitting masturbation. And, you know, we kind of had to focus to really advance the story and not just get lost in all the details. I focused on what I perceived to be national to, or to be relevant to the national conversations that we're having about race and gender right now in the country. And for me, that was focusing on Brad's views on free speech, limitless free speech. He seemed really concerned about, you know, needing to apologize for slavery or having white guilt. And he said, you know, we're kind of done with that. White, you know, identity politics is putting this undue burden on us as cisgender, straight white males. And then also I was driven by my own interest and that, you know, trying to find out how these guys even got involved in this group, because I had never heard of the Proud Boys. Most people I know have never heard of the Proud Boys. And they talked about feeling unwelcome for their conservative political viewpoints. It was a community where they could be open about their support for Trump, and just getting sucked into YouTube videos where a lot of these conservative commentators are speaking.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Alexandra Hall. She spent months reporting on a group called Proud Boys and a chapter here in Wisconsin. She's WPR's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And her piece aired earlier this week. We're talking about the media ethics and of covering controversial groups. What questions do you have about the decisions news leaders make as they report on contentious topics? Alex, I want to ask you about a specific editorial decision your team had to make. The piece includes some inflammatory language the group used when a female reporter was arranging an interview. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there was, I should say that I am the female reporter. I reported the story alone. We usually do not include reporters in the story, as you know, at WPR, nor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, but this incident motivated us to break the format somewhat. What happened was that I reached out to, as I mentioned, Eric, who's the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys, and I asked him for an interview. He said that he would consider it, and then late one Friday night, he sent me a message that said, should I bring the condoms? Because I know when you get the truth, you'll be ready. And then the next morning, very early, said, sorry about that. Got a little rowdy last night. And I didn't see it until Sunday morning. And at first, I was irritated because I felt this guy's wasting my time. These guys aren't serious. He's not taking me seriously. But then I thought, you know, I had conversation with my boss and, you know, I felt like, you know, maybe this is who they are. You know, they reject political correctness, limitless free speech. Their ideas about women are very clear. And so, you know, my boss at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism wanted to respond with, you know, an organizational response saying, you know, we as a news organization will not tolerate harassment of employees. But I kind of felt that it was worth, you know, letting it play out and seeing what else he had to say and letting him speak. And so that's where we decided to take it.
Luke on Facebook writes, WPR scrapes the bottom of the barrel with fake news. Alex, how would you respond to that? Is this fake news?
I think that's a funny term that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. The Proud Boys actually called me fake news when I first reached out to them. My perception is that that term comes from a lack of transparency about the process of the work that we do. I don't think people realize the time and energy that we put into not only to being completely accurate, but to being fair and really being genuinely curious about understanding the complex systems and the subjects that we're investigating. Oftentimes I hear that term used in reference to organizations like the New York Times and Washington Post that are doing amazing investigative work. At the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, we have a painfully rigorous fact-checking process in which for every story, we're sitting until, you know, it's usually 8 to 12 hours per story of fact-checking where we're in the office till 12:30 at night ordering pizza, getting a little delirious, you know, printing out a sheet of paper to verify every single, practically every single word of every line in every story. So, you know, that is our process. We invest a lot in understanding them and in being fair. And I think that if that's fake news and if we're being lumped in with these other news organizations, then I take that as a compliment.
As we start to wrap up here, what do you want people who listen to your piece, and we're about to hear it after the news break, or read, what do you want them to take away from this?
Well, I think that it's important to be aware that, as I said, there's a spectrum in and around of alt-right, that either did not exist in Wisconsin before the election. That's why we decided to report this story, but also either was active online and is now physically in the streets. There's protests and counter-protests all over the country in which these groups are showing up to defend the principles of limitless free speech. And, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that, as I said, it's not just, are you a Nazi, are you a white supremacist, or are you not? There's this gray area.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alexandra Hall is the Wisconsin Public Radio Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. The center distributes her work, and her stories air on WPR. Alex's latest story is called Controversial Proud Boys Embrace Western Values, Reject Feminism and Political Correctness. You can find her work at WPR.org and WisconsinWatch.org. When we come back, we'll hear the piece on Proud Boys in Wisconsin, and we'll dig deeper into a discussion about journalism coverage. Stay with us. The news is next. News organizations are responding to backlash as they strive to cover controversial perspectives. We're talking about the ethical guidelines media organizations in America attempt to follow as they put together stories in a changing social climate. You can join into this discussion, 800-642-1234. What is the obligation of a free press? Does it depend on the circumstances? What questions do you have about the decisions news leaders make as they report on divisive topics? 800-642-1234. We'll talk with an expert in media ethics in just a moment, but first, we'll hear the story on Proud Boys. Since the 2016 presidential election, groups on the right and left have taken their messages offline and into the street. Violent confrontations between members of the conservative alt-right masked anti-fascists and others have broken out at protests in Berkeley, Portland, and elsewhere since President Trump came into office. Alexandra Hall reports on one group that's finding ground in Wisconsin.
The Proud Boys have been called many names. What they call themselves is a fraternal organization, or men's club, for libertarians who want to meet up with other like-minded guys and drink beer. Most are young, white, and support President Trump.
And put these two beers and the fries on my tab. Those are my tab. And then
on a recent night at a brewery in a shopping mall just outside of Milwaukee, three men order a round of beers.
You boys need another beer? Anybody need a drink?
I'll take another.
Eric, Brad, and Patrick are all members of the Proud Boys from Southeast Wisconsin and Chicago. They ask that we not disclose their last names because they fear violent attacks on their members. Eric and Brad are both wearing the black and yellow Fred Perry polo shirts the Proud Boys are known for.
Proud Boys were coming up on just various online articles and sites and whatnot, so I decided to dig into it a little bit.
That's Eric. He's the president of the Wisconsin chapter of the Proud Boys. He says when he found out about the group earlier this year, he looked for a chapter to join in Wisconsin. At that point, one didn't even exist yet. So he started it.
I liked what I saw, basically. I liked that they weren't a white supremacist, white nationalist group, but they weren't trying to appease the left.
The Proud Boys have a lengthy list of causes. They include ending the war on drugs, giving everyone a gun, glorifying housewives and entrepreneurs, and declaring the West is the best. The first step to becoming a Proud Boy is saying you're a proud Western chauvinist who refuses to apologize for creating the modern world. Second degree, as you can hear in this YouTube video, involves getting punched by other guys while you try to name five breakfast cereals.
One, Cheerios, two, Frosted Flakes, three, Cocoa Puffs, four.
Third degree is getting a Proud Boy tattoo. And if you get into a fight with Antifa, the sometimes violent anti-fascist activists, you're an honorary fourth degree. When you get down to it, Eric, Brad, and Patrick say it's about free speech for everybody, even the white nationalists who organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Brad says even though they don't agree with those groups, they had a permit to be there and a right to express their views.
We have a platform. Black Lives Matter has a platform. And you know, I'm sorry for people that don't like it, but the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazis have a platform. That's free speech.
But the guys say this isn't about race. They think the left and identity politics have gone too far in trying not to offend anyone.
And we're done apologizing. None of us knew anybody that owned a slave. Personally, my family didn't emigrate here until the First World War. I share no white guilt. So I'm done being villainized as the white devil. I'm not him.
The Proud Boys' ideas are kind of all over the place. One thing they all believe in, though, is what they call Western values.
The West is about you doing it your own way and not being hindered by rules.
That's Gavin McGinnis. He was one of the co-founders of Vice Media. Since then, he's hosted a series of right-wing online talk shows. Last year, at the height of the presidential election, he founded the Proud Boys as a space where guys could be guys. He says he got the idea for Western values from reading Pat Buchanan's 2002 book, The Death of the West, how dying populations and immigrant invasions imperil our country and civilization. McGinnis says it was Trump's anti-political correctness that drew him in. He says there was this one moment when he knew Trump was his kind of politician.
What really did it for me was he was doing a press conference and they said, he was saying anchor baby, and some Hispanic journalist said,
are you aware that the term anchor baby, that's an offensive term. People find that hurtful.
You mean it's not politically correct, and yet everybody uses it?
Look it up in the dictionary. It's offensive.
Give me a different term. Give me a different term. What else would you like to say?
The child, the American-born child of an undocumented immigrant.
You want me to say that? Okay. I'll use the word anchor baby.
I'm saying, why do you have to use that phrase?
I'll use the word anchor baby.
And he sort of gave him this sort of gesture with his arm, like, you know, shoot him away. And I thought, oh, my God, we finally have a president who talks the way we all talk and is a human being, a non-politician politician.
McGinnis says that the media have overblown the actual scale and presence of white supremacists in the U.S., but he's open about his own feelings towards Muslims and women. His Twitter profile describes him as anti-Islam, and he talks on his show about how most women would be happier at home than in the workplace.
I would say feminism was done in maybe 1979. And since then, it's just been women inventing problems and lying to create a world where the feminists are needed, like saying one in four women will be sexually assaulted or raped in college, or saying that women earn less than men and there's a wage gap, like just blatant lies to justify their existence.
McGinnis says those are his views. You don't have to share them to join the Proud Boys, but they resonate with the guys.
The wage gap, predicated on a myth, verifiably false, and in some job fields, women are making more than their male counterparts.
Some have called the Proud Boys the alt-light, including those within the nationalist alt-right movement.
For our purposes here, I think you could define the alt-light as those who align themselves with the politics of the alt-right in the era of Trump without really addressing or associating with any issues of race or, you know, race or racism.
Ryan Lenz is a senior investigative writer with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Every year, the organization publishes a report on the groups espousing extremist ideas in the U.S. He says groups like the Proud Boys use humor and irony as a tool of plausible deniability.
If someone were to become critical of the Proud Boys, all they'd have to do is look to the process by which one becomes a Proud Boy, and they could say, look, you guys are stupid. You're actually taking this as face value and thinking we're a threat. So it's this weird sort of thing. You don't know if it's actually real or if it's a joke. But I'll tell you this, like in the streets, like, you know, during these alt-right rallies, when the Proud Boys show up, you know, to defend the First Amendment principles of racists and extremists, you know, that is not a joke. It's very real and very serious.
In May, a member of the Proud Boys was ambushed and beaten in downtown Madison. According to police records, the victim said he believed the perpetrators were Antifa. Last month, a UW-Madison grad student, who the Proud Boys were vetting as a possible new member, agreed to give up his teaching duties after a blog post alleged he had a history of spreading racist and anti-Semitic messages at another university. Again, Ryan Lenz.
The reality is that the ideologies that people have who gravitate toward being a Proud Boy, you know, the ideologies of anti-Islam, as Gavin has on his Twitter page, or, you know, or anti-feminism, these are things that play deeply into the grains of the alt-right.
As of now, researchers at the Southern Poverty Law Center have not designated the Proud Boys a hate group, although they're considering them for next year's report. And one of the reasons is that the group is so new. They're still waiting to see what the Proud Boys become. Alexandra Hall, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. It came out of a collaboration with ProPublica on their Documenting Hate project. Doreen Weisenhaus joins us now. She is director of the Media Law and Policy Initiative at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She also teaches in the School of Law. She taught media law and ethics in journalism at the University of Hong Kong for 17 years. Weisenhaus also directed an educational resource for students, scholars, lawyers, journalists, and other media professionals. She's a former city editor of the New York Times. And between college and grad school, she worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Doreen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you just heard this piece. It's generated lots of questions and critiques from our audience. What is your reaction to the story about the Proud Boys in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it served an important purpose. I read it quite carefully. I listened to it, compared it to other coverage. And I think while it's a distasteful topic to many people, what it tried to do is document that there is this emerging group in the state of Wisconsin. And I think in the way it's been described as part of this larger Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism reporting for Documenting Hate, that there is this broader effort to try to identify new groups that might possibly be considered hate groups in the future. So I think it serves an important social function.
And some listeners, though, don't believe the story has a place on the air or online. And we see what the New York Times did with their story in issuing both an editor's note and a reporter's note. What obligation do news outlets have to report what they see, what they dig up?
Well, they obviously have an obligation to report on what is happening in society, day-to-day life, not just the typical stories of following government and politics, and those more structured events, but what is really going on in society. But that said, they do have an obligation. Oftentimes it's written up in their ethics guide to be fair, to give all sides, to report as impartially as possible, to have integrity. The New York Times has I worked there for a number of years. We have a 57-page ethics guideline in which it documents everything from you have to, report about your conflict of interest and other ethical standards. But a key element is that you have to be fair and you have to do your fact-checking. The Washington Post has an even more detailed discussion about what is fairness. If a story is fair, is not fair if it omits facts of major importance or significance. And I think that's where the Times got into trouble with their story. They did a profile of someone who said that he was an alt-right white supremacist, founder of a national party that advocated these hateful issues. And people objected that it seemed to normalize him, that it didn't go into any great detail about what his ideas were, what his online presence was. And so many people criticized it, said that it wasn't a complete story.
But if you can't get the complete story and you've talked to the subject again and again and you keep getting the same answers, it sounds like you have to make a decision at that point. And news outlets do select stories to cover, but they can also really pick and choose. Can you parse that out for us and figure out, what do you choose? How do you figure out what to put out there?
Right. Well, so I'll contrast the two stories. So the Wisconsin story did talk to a number of these individuals, but then they broadened out as well. They talked to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which said, no, they're not a hate group at this time, but we're keeping an eye on them. They seem to have kind of a broader net as to how they were reporting the story. For the New York Times story, they did talk to a couple of friends, but a lot of people have critiques it and says, yes, he did not say what he was thinking, but that they could get more about what he was thinking by looking at his online postings. You know, what was he saying in his podcast? What was he saying in, on social media? Did they talk to the family? There seems to be no reference of trying to contact family or a broader number of friends to try to get at what he's saying. That said, you're right. It is difficult, you know, once a subject declines to give any more, what you need to do about it. But then that you're making an editorial decision as to whether you go with the story or not.
And Alex Hall, who we just spoke to before the piece, said there is a lot of gray area, and it's hard to figure out what quotes to use, what you should focus on, what strategies do organizations and reporters use to find a middle ground, if you will, between downplaying the significance of a controversial subject and then perhaps glorifying it or giving it an undue spotlight.
Well, I think what the Times attempt on this was certainly not to try to normalize it through the story itself, but to describe the degree to which this type of hate speech, this type of extreme views, is far more normal than we realize. And so I think that was the statement by the national editor who had to give an explanation that this is very uncomfortable territory for us. But that it needed to be done, that it's not always going to be what you might see at protests, you know, that they're skinheads, that they're, you know, very extreme fringe people, but they might be your next door neighbor. And I think for that intent purpose, they accomplished that.
Let's go to Steve, who joins us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm someone that's getting I don't want to say attracted to some of these groups, but I see some commonalities in their beliefs with me personally, in my experience, because what I see is news media such as NPR or New York Times or Washington Post always doing exposés on these fringe groups that are racist in nature, but I very rarely see anything on groups that are on the left, such as Madison Antifa, who I liked on Facebook. And I'm appalled by some of the things that they post. And these groups are growing and growing on college campuses in Madison and even individuals believing in that. But there's never any type of expose on that. So I think you, by only focusing on one side, you're attracting people to those types of groups.
Doreen, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's Steve, right?
Steve,
Yeah, there have been a number of stories, particularly when some of these protest movements were going on over the course of the summer. Further on, Newsweek did a big story, Atlantic Magazine. I know the New York Times has done some stories, but perhaps they're not getting the same kind of attention and certainly maybe not the same amount of frequency as some of the other stories. But there has been a fair amount of coverage of these groups.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for calling in and sharing. What is the right way to cover extremism? What is the right way to cover controversial groups? These are questions we're probing in light of media reports this week that explored the lives of people who hold controversial viewpoints. In the case of the New York Times, it was a Nazi sympathizer. In the case of WPR, it was a long-form feature story on the Proud Boys, which calls itself a men's group for libertarians. We're talking with Doreen Weisenhaus. She's director of the Media Law and Policy Initiative at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She teaches law and media ethics. She's a former city editor of the New York Times. You can join in 800-642-1234. What concerns you about coverage you've noticed in newspapers, radio, television, other online resources? What question do you have about the decisions news leaders make as they report on contentious topics? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. After the New York Times published a profile story on a Nazi sympathizer recently, it found itself facing an intense backlash for a piece that many claimed normalized hatred. Earlier this week, WPR aired a story that gave voice to the group The Proud Boys chapter in Wisconsin. We're discussing how to cover controversial voices in America this hour, gathering your thoughts on this as well at 800-642-1234. Doreen Weisenhaus stays with us. She teaches media ethics and law at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. Doreen, how does an audience's reaction and response change the way journalists think about the stories that they cover?
Well, clearly it had an impact because it got both a response from the national editor and from the reporter as well to give a deeper explanation as to what the thought process was behind the editorial decisions made and how they agonized over whether to go with the story or not. Richard Fawcett, the reporter, said, he quoted a hole at the heart of my story, recognizing that by not getting at the why this individual became white supremacist individual was definitely a flaw in the story. But at the same time, they felt that they needed to give a bigger explanation that sometimes they're a difficult story, a story that society doesn't want to hear. And if they're not going to report them, who will?
Let's bring in Jerry now, who joins us from Galena, Illinois. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hi. Listening carefully to this panel discussion, and would suggest that these journalistic investigations are absolutely necessary from this viewpoint. We have a lot of angry people in this country right now, and there are subgroups within our own cultural sphere that are expressing anger in their own way and coding their anger sociolinguistically in a way that requires us to listen and to investigate, do research on it, so that we understand better what this fermentation, this negative fermentation is that's going on in our country. So these journalistic efforts are positive because if they're bounded by listening to voices that are deeply, profoundly angry and disenfranchised, we will become a better country.
Jerry, thanks for calling in. Doreen, how should journalists and audiences work with or cope with movements and groups who are hard to describe and nearly impossible to define in familiar terms?
Well, I think Jerry raises a very good point, a very insightful point, which is it's in part describing the new vocabulary in which they have kind of coded meanings, and you have to kind of keep adding that onto the national dialogue. I mean, Richard Fawcett is not a newcomer to journalism. He's quite an experienced journalist with 20 years of experience. He was a foreign correspondent. He worked in Mexico City. He wrote about the ravages of the drug cartels and El Chapo and, you know, covered a lot of very important stories. So I think he does bring that responsibility and those skills to this story, and maybe he didn't get it 100% right, which he says in his own words that he didn't. But at the same time, it is an important story to cover, and you just kind of keep going to the next story and the next story and not give up, which is something that Jerry, one of your listeners, suggested.
So and you mentioned here another country. You spent more than 15 years teaching media and ethics in China. How is the ethics and journalism discussion different outside the United States?
Well, there's a big difference. I did a lot of research throughout Asia, and you more often will find more partisan media where, particularly through Southeast Asia, where a number of the media organizations are run or favorite opposition parties, political parties. And so you have to kind of sort out, you know, who are more of the general press, who are the state broadcasters, who are the partisan papers, and so on. So it's definitely a more difficult environment in trying to get more objective views. Now, online, of course, is quite popular around the world and certainly in Asia, and so that offers a more plurality of voices. So it's harder for the news consumer to try to sort out, you know, what's real, what's not. But there is a lot of important issues at stake, and you find a very active news consumer who tries to find out what's really going on.
Alex Hall, the reporter on the Proud Boys story, encountered fake news in her reporting. First, in trying to get interviews, the people she wanted to interview accused her of being covering, you know, of being a fake news outlet, perhaps. How does this notion of, air quotes, fake news factor into this?
Well, what it does is unfortunately, the conversation has shifted quite a lot in the last year and a half, where fake news before that time was considered literally news that was not true. It's now taken on a different definition reported by President Trump and others as well. It's news that you don't agree with. And so that's considered fake news as well. So it makes it quite difficult for the news consumer to say, well, what is news and who can we trust? And I think you have to keep going back to the idea that there are organizations, if they stay true to their editorial integrity, such as Wisconsin Public Radio, such as the New York Times, such as the Washington Post, such as other news organizations, that that's really the best that they can do to try to combat this fake news designation that people want to fling at them.
And in the process, in trying to be objective, are American journalists doing their job? What does objectivity really mean in this day and age?
Well, I think I go back to the definition of the Washington Post that they have in their ethics policy is that it's about being fair and objective, meaning that you have to not omit facts of major importance or significance, that you have to try to be as complete as possible. You have to be able to decide what is irrelevant, what is significant, and that you can't mislead or deceive the readers, that they have to be as honest as possible. And if there's difficulties in the reporting, reveal that to the reader. And I think the more transparent that you can be with your reader, with your viewer, with your listener, with whoever is following you, that you have a better chance of building that credibility.
Sometimes in broadcast here, we will call it a signpost when we're in a story. You're right. Telling someone, hey, listen, let's take a time out here. I need to tell you something, give you a heads up as you listen to this next sentence, word, whatever. Is lifting the veil a little bit on how the journalism is done? Can that help with this whole issue of what we trust and what we read?
I think that the more transparent you can be with the process, then I think you can people can see what is being done, and then there can be a building of trust between the consumer of your news or your story or whatever information that you're doing, and you eventually have this reputation that you are going to be transparent, that you do have integrity, that you will try your best. But that's not to say that you won't make mistakes. I mean, we are all human, right? And so there will be mistakes made from time to time. But I think the overall intent is to do a good and fair job. And I think that's what people have to keep in mind.
And another part of lifting that veil is showing people what fact-checking really means. What does fact-checking mean, Doreen?
Well, fact-checking means that you don't just talk to the source of the individual. And I think that's what some people objected to the New York Times story, because it felt like it was so much just based on the individual that was profiled. And people would have liked to see more. Did you talk to more friends? Did you talk to people that he worked with? Did you talk to the father who was a veteran? their conflict here, that what that might have done would be to give more context and more of an understanding as to what was the whole at the heart of the story, which is the why. Why did he become what he became? So I think that is something that people were looking for.
And after all that fact-checking is done, what about when your readers or your listeners or whom your audience doesn't care or doesn't believe the facts that you provide, even with the direct proof?
Well, I think you just have to show, soldier on. I think there was a very interesting story done recently with the Washington Post, in which they were approached by someone who was peddling a fake news story, which was a woman who was saying that she was a victim of Roy Moore, the candidate running for the Senate in Alabama. And basically, they were part of a conservative right group that was trying to trick the Washington Post into kind of revealing things that might have been considered discriminatory. And the Washington Post never ran the story. They were checking her story out. They were interviewing other people. They didn't just take her word for it that she was a victim of Roy Moore, but that they never went with that story. So I think that was kind of a revelatory for people that what these news organizations were doing. They weren't just having the victims come forward alleging sexual harassment of various men. They actually reported out. They tried to get verification. They tried to, find out what was going on at the time these incidents were alleged to have happened. So I think the more the public is aware of how fact-checking is done, I think perhaps they will have more confidence in the stories that result.
Doreen, thank you so much for taking time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Doreen Weisenhaus is director of the Media Law and Policy Initiative at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She also teaches in the School of Law. She taught media ethics and law in journalism at the University of Hong Kong for 17 years. She's a former city editor of the New York Times. And between college and grad school, she worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Earlier, we talked with Alexandra Hall. She's WPR's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Noah Ovchinsky is WPR's news director. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation is on the Ideas Network.